Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The Winter Olympics in 2002 wasn't the first time Utah made a bid to get the Games. State and city leaders had their eyes on the 72 Olympics. Our producer Benjamin Bombard has been looking into the story, and he told us the effort really began in the 1960s. The Utah delegation did the usual schmoozing at international cocktail parties. They sold Olympic pins to pay for promotional materials. But Ben says they knew that to get the Games, they were going to have to go big.
There was just one critical piece of infrastructure that Salt Lake City lacked: an auditorium. And then they also had to pick a spot, a couple blocks in downtown Salt Lake City, just kitty-corner from Temple Square. The thing is that at that time, and for decades prior to that, those blocks were home to a very robust and vibrant community of Japanese and Japanese Americans who called the area Japantown. There were dozens of businesses owned by Japanese Americans on these couple of blocks downtown. Retail shops, markets, gas stations, hotels, a pool hall, cafes. There were apartment buildings, families who lived down there. Japanese Americans from across Utah and really from across the West would come to Salt Lake City's Japantown because it was just so vibrant, especially in the wake of World War II. It was one of the few very vibrant Japantowns left. That is where Salt Lake City leaders said that they were going to put what ended up being the Salt Lake County Civic Auditorium, later to be called, of course, the Salt Palace. In the dozens of newspaper reports, you'll see references to Japanese Americans, to the Japanese community. But nowhere is it ever really acknowledged that this was a cohesive social enclave, that this was a community with roots there, that had a name for this place, that this was Japantown. And it was being destroyed. Salt Lake City condemns Japantown through the use of eminent domain. They just took the land, and then the wrecking balls started swinging in January 1966. One newspaper account described it as looking like a battleground. There were these husks of buildings, just skeletons really, with their window shades kind of flapping in the breeze, buildings crushed like crumpets. This area had just been completely demolished. It wiped out dozens of Japanese American businesses. People who were living there had to relocate elsewhere. This entire community that had been thriving there for decades was basically just leveled. When the dust settled, all that was left standing was an apartment building or two, a couple businesses, and the Japanese Buddhist church and the Japanese Christian church. That was all that was left of Japantown. That was 58 years ago. And now here we are today. And Japantown is once again at the center of plans for another big sports dream. Ryan Smith, the billionaire owner of the Utah Jazz, the newly acquired NHL team, he has ambitions to build a multi-billion dollar sports and entertainment district in the footprint of what was originally Japantown. And there's also plans, as part of this project, to create a metals plaza that would serve the next coming of the Winter Olympics to Salt Lake City, possibly in 2034. And there's a chance maybe this time that some sort of reparations may be made and some kind of honor may be paid to the memory and the history of Japantown and the Japanese American citizens that gave it life. The plans right now amount to a kind of gussying up of what's now Japantown Street, where the Japanese Buddhist Church and the Japanese Christian Church are, and to remove some kind of unsightly views from the surrounding businesses and buildings and stuff. But members of the Japanese American community are still waiting to see that and still wondering if it's going to happen, if Japantown and its memory will truly be honored. Oh, and about that Olympic bid. Everybody knows Salt Lake City didn't win the 1972 Winter Olympics. But you know who did? Sapporo, Japan.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So there's a deadline to keep in mind in this story. Two of them, in fact. Utah lawmakers passed a law that allows Salt Lake City to create this sports district and to hike city sales tax to pay for part of it. But they have to reach a deal with the Utah Jazz owner Ryan Smith by September 1st. That's deadline number one. Deadline number two comes next Tuesday. That's when the Salt Lake City Council is set to vote on the district. We talked to KUER reporter Sean Higgins, and we asked him just how much Japantown figures into Ryan Smith's plan.
From the statements that have been made publicly, either to the Salt Lake City Council or elsewhere, they are thinking about this. Smith Entertainment Group executive Mike Mon told the City Council in May that they did meet with Japantown representatives, heard concerns about the loading docks on the north side of the street there on 100 South, and that the Smith Entertainment Group has every intention to replace those loading docks with street-facing spaces that intend to enliven the area even more. What complicates it is that looking at the initial plans that have been proposed to the Salt Lake Planning Commission, Japantown is not part of that rezone they're asking for. It's just outside of that area, but that north loading dock area is.
So they're only worried about or only maybe thinking about part of Japantown?
I think the part that is directly connected to what is now the Salt Palace, yes, they are worried about that. If anyone has gone down there, it's just directly across from the Buddhist temple.
Yep.
There's some trees and a little bit of fencing, but it's literally loading docks for semi-trucks that are there right now. It's quite ugly. Not much of a reason to be there unless you're going to church. So I think they're really thinking about this as a holistic community space going forward, but there are a lot of bureaucratic steps that need to happen before will have any real idea of what that will look like.
You know, what's interesting is that it seems like Smith and the, you know, his partners with the Smith Entertainment Group, that they made a lot of concessions to keep, you know, these sports teams downtown and to build this district. I mean, they were going to go out south where they could have as much space as they wanted almost. So now they're going to have to squeeze it into, as I said, this, you know, 2-3 block area. So how much room are they going to be willing to work with, and how much attention do they want to really pay for this? As far as you can tell, the thing they're worried about then is just, look, we'll clean up the loading docks. We'll make this a nice thing, but we're not going to grant any more space or any more room. This is – we'll deal with what's there and that'll be it. Is that right?
I think a lot of that hinges on what the city does. Will approve as far as the rezone they're looking at.
Yeah.
So last week, the Salt Lake Planning Commission did not recommend this rezone to the city council.
Yeah.
They did have some recommendations, but they did say the program or the project is moving a little too fast for them. And a lot of what this particular zone, that north side of Japantown, will look like, could look like in the future, hinges on what the city approves as far as this rezone is concerned. And that's not to say that this will stop the project.
Yeah.
The Planning Commission can only recommend things one way or another. They're not a deciding body. The city council ultimately has that say. So as this process moves forward, this rezone will now be presented to the city council, and whether the Smith Entertainment Group does take those recommendations from the Planning Commission into account when they do present this to the city council, we'll find out a little bit later this year. But they've got a big plan, and a lot needs to happen.
What did you hear in your reporting about the way Japanese Americans here are talking about and thinking about not just what's happening in Japantown now, but what happened to that community in the 60s?
I think there is a lot of cautious optimism, emphasis on the word cautious, because they're a community that was literally and figuratively steamrolled in the 1960s when it came to the construction of the original Salt Palace. And especially for older generation Japanese Americans, there's a lot of bad tastes in their mouths when it comes to how that process went down. Eminent domain was declared and dozens of businesses and hundreds of residents essentially had to vacate where they were to make way for this big project.
And State Senator, I'll just mention Jenny Iwamoto. You talked to her for your reporting. She said the Salt Palace had obliterated the Japanese community.
Mm-hmm. And she told me a story about how Japantown was really kind of a safe space for a lot of these people to go and meet friends who they would not interact with otherwise in other parts of the city. This was really a cultural hub for the Japanese community here in Utah.
So their expectations are, it sounds like, realistic. They're not expecting in some way Japantown to return in the form that it was, but they do want some attention paid, I guess. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely fair to say, and I think it works in the community's favor that before any of the Smith Entertainment Group things happened earlier this year, there was plans to revitalize the street, at least aesthetically, with Salt Lake City. That process started, I believe, in 2018. There were some plans released during the height of the pandemic of what that could possibly look like. Really beautiful art installations lining the street with cherry trees.
Yeah, there are photos and renderings.
Yeah, beautiful renderings of what the street could look like. And I think it is my impression that the city is still moving forward on that. Those plans, where those are in the process, I think some of that got complicated with the Smith Entertainment Group wanting to rezone that whole area.
Yeah.
But I think speaking with people like Janie Iwamoto, that's a priority for them. Keeping that revitalization project of the street, the beautification of the street, at the forefront of their minds as they're working through this entire process. I think, like you said, I don't think anyone is expecting hundreds of businesses to move back to that stretch. But I think recognizing what did happen there and having it be a more of a cultural center rather than a business district is where it's headed right now.
What about city and county leaders? How important is Japantown for them?
Judging by public statements, it is at the forefront of their minds. Certainly, County Mayor Jenny Wilson and Mayor Aaron Mendenhall here have both said that the Japanese community is an integral part of the fabric of Salt Lake City, and they have every intention of honoring that moving forward. So obviously, public statements are one thing. When you have an agreement on paper, that's another thing. But talking with people in the community, they're, like I said, cautiously optimistic about how this is moving forward. I think they see it more of an opportunity than a risk for them right now. But they want to be on top of it and involved in the process moving forward to make sure it does come to fruition like they're envisioning.
Say something about Darren Mano. He's on the city council. He's a fourth generation Japanese American. He's been really outspoken about reviving Japantown in some way, about making Japantown part of this negotiation. He's pretty adamant that something be done here.
He has said multiple times that he is a firm no vote on any of this revitalization if Japantown is not in the mix and has not wavered from that one bit as far as I know. So I think having him as an advocate on the council certainly brings the attention to the forefront for the rest of the council. I attended a town hall meeting with the Japanese community a few weeks ago, and council member Sarah Young spoke as well on behalf of the council, saying that they are behind the community when it comes to this. And a lot of that is thanks to Councilor Mano as well, really bringing this to the forefront and explaining the history behind how this happened and the bad feelings that still do exist in that community for what happened in the 1960s.
Do you think, I know you don't know this for sure, but do you gather that for the city council, Japantown, its inclusion in the process is kind of a deal breaker for them?
I would say yes. If it is not included, it is a deal breaker.
What do Japanese Americans here now, what would you say they want? When you talk to them, what are they saying that they want?
I spoke specifically with a group of young Japanese Americans who had parents or grandparents that grew up knowing what Japantown was. And I get the sense that they want recognition of what did happen there, kind of honoring their culture and their contributions to Utah, and just having a space where they can feel proud of their not just Japanese American heritage, but Japanese American Utah heritage, because many of these families have been here long before the 1960s. We hear about the first Japanese people coming here in the 1800s and some of them staying. It's a little bit under the surface and not many people really realize it, but there's a rich tradition of Japanese culture in Utah that goes back decades and decades.
I like how one of the younger Japanese Americans you talked to, Trey Imamura, put it. He compared all of this to a baseball game. Say what he said.
Yeah, he told me that if we think of it as a baseball game, they lost the game in the 1960s. And he said a lot of that was because we didn't have people going to bat for us. We didn't have people in the outfield that were playing on our team. And he said now he feels like they have a real shot to win this game because they have, I think he said, we have the mayors in the outfield. We have the city council at first base for us. And they're feeling largely good about it. I think they're really optimistic about the possibility of what this could become, with the caveat of knowing the history of this area and what did happen and not wanting those past mistakes to be repeated again.
And it feels like they're fielding a team.
It does, certainly.
Sean, thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
Sean Higgins, he's a politics reporter for KUVR. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of Japantown. For decades, it was a thriving community in the heart of downtown Salt Lake City. But nearly 60 years ago, the core of it was condemned to make way for the Salt Palace. Now, as a new sports district is being mapped out, we've been talking about what happens to what's left of Japantown. We talked to Floyd Morey this week. He's a Japanese-American historian who grew up here in Utah. And he told us there were Japantowns like the one in Salt Lake City throughout the country.
Japantowns in the United States probably started back in the 19-teens, mainly on the West Coast. California, by the wartime, I think had about 40 Japantowns. Today, only three survive.
Wow.
Portland had a very significant Japantown, Seattle, and Salt Lake City. Besides Salt Lake City, Ogden had a sort of a Japantown up there, and Denver has Japantown. So they're on the western United States. That's where most of the Japanese settled.
How did these Japantowns develop? How did they come about? You're right that like other immigrants in the story of this country, the Japanese did not find a welcoming world for the most part.
In order to establish business, to do some commerce, to get goods that they needed, they established some retail and commercial establishments, restaurants, hotels. And as new immigrants came, they needed some place to stay. So many restaurants, grocery stores, fish markets, the things that Japanese needed apart from what was available in American stores.
So there was a practical part to this. I'm guessing there was also kind of an identity part that was important as well.
Right. You know, Japanese were really not welcome. Asians were not welcome.
Yeah.
Going back to the 1800s and the Exclusion Act, which excluded Chinese from coming after they'd built the railroad,
yeah.
And then in 1907 it was, there was an agreement with Japan that they would stop immigration. And then in the 1920s, a new law passed that, again, prevented Asians from coming to the United States. So, you know, Asians were not welcome, Japanese being one of them in that era of time. And I think a matter of developing your community and being together became important to them just to survive.
What were the struggles? You mentioned this, but say a little bit more about the struggles for Japanese people here. I know it's a long story that you detail in your writing. One of the things you mention is that as the population of Japanese people began to grow in this country, the U.S. tried to limit that by passing these laws. Like you say, they weren't allowed to purchase property, for example, in California. They weren't permitted to become for-a-time naturalized citizens.
Right. I think you know, Japanese came initially as laborers, and they worked on the railroad. They worked in farms and gradually began to establish their own farms like my father did. And there were others that began businesses. But in California, Japanese really got into farming, and only a small percent of the population in California did a very large percentage by the 1920s. 20s and 30s, a large percentage of the vegetable farming in California. And so there was some degree of, political fear by the farm organizations that the Japanese are going to take over. Huh. And so when the war came, it was a lot of the farm organizations that really supported getting the Japanese out of California. And, you know, here in Utah, Japanese farmed. My father was one.
Yeah.
Utah Valley here in Salt Lake Valley, up in Corinne, Box Elder area, a lot of Japanese farmers. And they provided the vegetables for Utah. And that's what my father did. But, you know, we go into the 50s and 60s and the change in technology, refrigeration. Mm-hmm. Transportation of trucks, California vegetables began to take over supermarkets here in Utah, where we did most of the wholesale marketing before then. Then California corporate farms came in. And so a lot of the smaller farm, family farms began to fade away. And, you know, like myself, kids after they grew up on the farm, decided to go to college or find a job someplace else.
You don't want to be a farmhand anymore.
Didn't want to be a farmhand, and it was, you know, it was difficult. It's a hard work. So many just got out of farming.
What was – how did your father talk about – and your own experience, I guess, as well – how was he treated by the what I would gather majority Latter-day Saint population? How was he treated by
Utahns? You know, my mother was 16, settled in Cache Valley, small little community, Lewiston. So their experience early was just fine. They got along well in Cache Valley. What took them out of Cache Valley was the nematode disease. They raised a lot of sugar beets, and the nematodes ruined the sugar beet crop. And my father decided, well, maybe he'll go to California. And so he loaded everything up and started south. But he stopped in Gunnison, where some friends and relatives lived. And they talked him into staying.
Wow.
And so he continued to farm vegetables down in Gunnison, Utah. I'm told the family lived in a log cabin with a dirt floor, struggled. But again, they were treated fine. It was when the war came that a little bit, you know, discrimination occurred. My father was a very kind person. You know, I remember as a kid, he would take the best of the crop, whatever it was, and he'd take it around to the neighbors, the best. So the neighbors, be they LDS, and we had some Catholic neighbors too, really liked my father and respected him because he was just a kind, generous guy. So my father got along pretty good with the neighbors. As you go wider, it became a little bit more difficult. Yeah. So the discrimination occurred.
We'll come back to the experience at World War II in a moment. I want to ask about Japantowns, I guess in general, like what were they like? You mentioned in your writing they had churches, they had newspapers, of course, they had schools. The architectural styles tried to mimic back home, I guess. What were they like?
Yes, it was as a kid, again, I grew up during the war and after the war, so my parents went to Japantown a lot. We lived out and started in Murray when I was born, but we moved out to Sandy. And
you went downtown to Japantown.
Went downtown to Japantown for grocery shopping.
Sure.
My dad went there for a haircut, and it was always a treat for me to go down there and be around. But yes, the hotels were run by Japanese. Several restaurants were run by Japanese. The churches were there. The Christian church is now 100 years old, and the Buddhist church was there. So it was, a place where you'd run into people, and, of course, the proprietors of these businesses you would know and get acquainted with.
How did Salt Lake's Japantown, do you think, compare to others in the country?
I think it was comparable, particularly as we move from pre-war to post-war.
Huh.
Pre-war was all local Japanese, the farmers and the commercial people that had developed here in the city. I think it was similar. I've been to many Japantowns, those that faded away as well as those that exist now. But, again, you have the restaurants, you have the stores, the drug stores, the churches are there. Some of the bigger Japantowns have community centers. Areas where Japanese people can gather.
Yeah.
Celebrations are there, different kinds of celebrations, cherry blossom festivals. Mm-hmm. There are Buddhist Obon festivals. So a lot of that is centered around these various Japantowns, be it San Francisco or San Jose has one, and right. L.A., Los Angeles.
But it seems like what you're saying is there was something – this is quite obvious – something changed after World War II or during the war. So let's talk about what happens. Of course, President Roosevelt signs this order that in effect calls for the imprisonment of some 120,000 Japanese people in internment camps. What did that mean for Japantowns? And we'll talk about what happened in the Japantown in Utah, which is different, interestingly. But what did that mean for Japantowns when that order came?
Well, the order was short. You had to get rid of what you had, and you, with two suitcases, whatever you could carry, that's what you did. And, some people had a caretaker that would take care of their property. There were some angels in San Jose, Fresno, some lawyers, some guys that were very kind and maintained the property and make sure the deeds were kept up. But for the most part, most everybody lost, whether it's their home or their business. So Japantown's basically closed up with the war because there's no Japanese, of course.
Of course.
And so many of them just after that never revived because they had nothing to come back to.
Right.
Salt Lake being a little different because –
Yeah, let's talk about that. Salt Lake did not have to close down completely during the Japantown did not have to close down completely during World War II. Why is that?
I think local people realized, the authorities realized they're no danger. I mean, they've been here a long time. And there were others that came during the war because if you had family or sponsors here – people from California or otherwise could come here rather than having to go to
the camps.
To the camps.
Huh.
So rather than leaving Japantown, there was more of an influx of Japanese to Salt Lake City. And then after the war, those that were in camps, many came here because they had nothing to go back to on the West Coast. And so the Japantown continued to thrive after World War II.
But why would that be? Why would Salt Lake City, mostly white, why would that be different from anywhere else that shunned Japanese people, that were felt threatened by them, worried by them?
You know, that was there. There was some of that.
Sure.
But it was an established Japantown. Huh. And, you know, the people that dealt with the Japanese here in Utah, most Japanese here in Utah would say they didn't sense that severe discrimination that was on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. You know, Japanese weren't the threat that they were economically in California. And so politically, there's a lot of verbiage where that kind of thing did not exist here in Salt Lake City. It was there.
Sure.
Particularly, you know, people went to the Pacific to war. Sons didn't come back. Yeah. Fathers didn't come back. So there's a feeling mostly among older people that maybe had some kind of experience and that prejudice had existed. So, you know, I think for the most part, Utah was welcoming, like Colorado. The governor of Colorado welcomed the Japanese to come. And basically communities here were welcoming, and it was a shock at the beginning because Japantown, they were closed down for a while when the war began.
Wait, in Salt Lake?
In Salt Lake.
It was closed down for a while.
Yeah. A lot of establishments all over the country were because they had to investigate, you know, the loyalty of these people. And you
so
know,
it eventually stayed open, but for a time there was a question.
Yeah, yeah. And it was more government, not community. It was more government at
I
that
see.
Time. Yeah.
What do you think let me jump forward 20 years or so from the war. What do you know about and what do you think about what happened in the mid-1960s when this civic auditorium was proposed basically on the place where Japantown was in Salt Lake? Now, I don't want to suggest what happened to Japantown is comparable to the federal government imprisoning, you know, Japanese people in internment camps, but it seems to fit in some kind of continuum there, I wonder. And so what do you think about that, about basically them condemning large swaths of land in Japantown to build a sports facility?
Well, I think, you know, that era of Utah – minorities were not relevant. And, you know, they were here, we were here. There was a degree of Polynesian population here at that time. The big growth of Asian population was, you know, after Korean War, after the Vietnamese War. So you look at the 60s and the growth hadn't begun. Restaurants were really confined to that area. There are a few Chinese restaurants around town also. But there was no consciousness of culture other than the existing culture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were just there, and there was no value of preserving that, even though, you know, in my mind, and I think as people look back, it's something that should have been preserved.
It was a vibrant, thriving community.
Yeah.
We've heard, as we've been exploring this issue, we've heard of what happened to Japantown in the 1960s in Salt Lake, described as cultural genocide. What do you think about that term? And maybe not just whether it's the precise or right term for what happened. Maybe you think it is, but just what it seems to say about how people felt about what happened.
Well, in Utah, minorities were insignificant in many ways. And so I think it wasn't in the mind of many people at that time that, oh, this is something we need to make sure stays there. Whereas the LDS Church, being long time here, when they tore that church down, when was it, a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, mm-hmm. there was a big cry because it was a heritage element.
It's a piece of history. Yeah.
Yeah. And Japantown was a very major part of history of Utah.
Yeah.
And it became significant for United States, as I mentioned, because people gathered here. The Japanese American Citizens League headquartered here during the war. Mm-hmm. And so Salt Lake became significant, and then people didn't understand or see that. And wiping away, you know, didn't matter. Had somewhat of an impact on the community, where we used to have a lot of broad community participation. Mm-hmm. And I got to know people in the city because there were gatherings of Japanese. There was a Buddhist picnic every year up in Davis High School. And I looked forward to that because I got to see some guys I'd seen last year, and I get to see them again this year. There were baseball leagues. There were basketball leagues. And they're all gone. While you look at some other areas where the Japanese have kept together, those kind of elements still exist. You know, now we're in our fifth and sixth generation of Japanese Americans. They just don't understand or have that experience that we had as people in the 40s and 50s up through the 60s.
So you're saying that – because one of the questions I wanted to ask was, okay, so what did it mean that Japantown was basically condemned, paved over, and built over? What did that mean? And what you're saying is it really stripped away – a sense of identity and community. It seems what you're saying, Mr. Mori, is that it's had a powerful effect.
It has. And, you know, you look at the existing institutions that are there, the Christian church and the Buddhist church, they still exist.
Yeah.
But I think there's a degree of struggling because reaching out into the community, there's nothing to bring them except the church itself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, social activity is critical to the human being. And I think sometimes taking that away is a very difficult thing for a community. And, you know, my grandkids just don't have that experience of what I experienced as a kid. Watching my brothers play basketball and baseball, and then I got involved in some of that stuff. But by the time I got involved, some of it had begun to disintegrate. I left Utah in 65, about the time that Japantown was demolished. And so I didn't directly get to experience what
the aftermath.
The aftermath, yeah. Did. But, you know, when I moved back, you know, where do you go to get Japanese food?
Right.
How do you get together the community people? So one of the things that I did when I came back to Utah was I developed what is now the Japan Festival, which has become, you know, we get thousands of people now, whereas there was no other thing like that before. And so families can come, organizations can do some stuff other than just the church things. There's a community thing that happens, and I think it's revived the community somewhat because people are much more involved.
So I wonder what should happen to Japantown now. I don't think anyone thinks Japantown is going to be revived. So what's the best, maybe the most realistic outcome, do you think, for Japantown in Salt Lake City, or what's left of it?
Well, you know, I think there's some positive discussion about developing some kind of commercial activity there on First South. where the churches are.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be redeveloped or revitalized, as they're calling it.
Yeah.
Well, let's revitalize some of that atmosphere there. I would like to see some space set aside for a museum where there be exhibits of what was there and, you know, what the community is now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, doing both allows the community to really show not just on a one-day festival but on a permanent basis what's going on. I see this a lot in ethnic areas throughout the country, but Japan towns in California, they all have museums, and it becomes a very important draw point for not only Japanese but the community itself. L.A., there are thousands of school kids that come to that museum and get to learn about the history of what happened and that Japan and Japanese are part of that community. And I'd like to see that here.
You know, when you think about the scale of just the amount of resources and money and just basic capitalistic incentive that's going to go into play to build this sports district down there, when you think about that, do you feel suspicious, worried about what will – when the dust finally settles – what will become of Japantown? Do you feel – or do you feel hopeful?
I am one who feels hopeful because as I've talked to some of the decision makers, city council, the mayors, seem to be all supportive of supporting and preserving and revitalizing some of that Japantown. But the concept they're talking here I think is something that can be very positive and can be cultural. And can be beneficial for a long time. I'm hopeful.
Floyd Maury, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Floyd Maury, he's a former national president of the Japanese American Citizens League. He's written about Japan towns in the U.S. We have a link to his work on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
My name's Paul Iwasaki. I was born and raised in Salt Lake City. In 1952 was when I was born. And at that time, we lived in the heart of J-Town. A lot of people call it Japantown. I refer to it as J-Town. Sometimes I'll call it Nihonmachi. We lived in number 60 Whitmore Court, apartment number 8. Directly above us lived my grandparents and my aunt, Titsuru. Let's start at the corner of what is now 3rd West and 1st South. On the corner is a three-story building called the Struve Building. Directly adjacent to that is the Japanese Church of Christ. And as kids, we would go in there, play in the courtyard behind the Japanese Church of Christ, and ride our bikes through there. It was all paved. And I used to go down there and hit tennis balls. And Peter Hirose, who was the minister's son, and I were the same age, so we hung around a lot. Climb up on the roof of the church and things like that. And just have a good old time. And across the street was the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple. The reverend at that time was Reverend Sanada. They would also show Japanese movies. And then you'd come to the Eagle Laundry. Once a week, I'd have to get the laundry, throw that in my little red wagon and haul it down to the Eagle Laundry, drop off the dirty laundry and pick up the clean laundry and haul it on back. All these people were just nice. I mean, they were just so pleasant and loving and caring and welcoming. So anyway, You go along further east along First Ave, and Mike's Barbershop, run by a guy named Mike Martinez. But to tell you how close this community was, a number of years after all of this, my father got hurt at work, slipped and fell, broke both of his shoulders. And Mike Martinez heard about that. And he broke out his barbering tools and would come up to give my dad a haircut. That's the kind of tightness and collegiality that community had for one another. So then there's an alleyway right next to the Pagoda and Colonial Hotel that ran north and south. That would kind of be my shortcut to go to school. Couldn't let my mom know because she didn't want me going through the bus depot. California Market was run by Mr. and Mrs. Wada. I never knew their first name. I had the cheekiness to just go, "Hello, Wada." My mom heard that and gave me a good one. Come to the Aloha Fountain, run by Wally and Mary. Wally Doy taught me everything I knew about baseball, not just the physical. That, too, was a real gathering spot. And then next to that was a judo dojo. As kids growing up, we all took judo. Family Market was run by Mike and T. Nakamura, two wonderful people, by your Japanese goods there. Sage Market, run by the Toinakas. New Sunrise Fish Market, Nagazawa's. And then next to that, I think, was a pool hall. I did sneak in there a couple times, but I know I wasn't supposed to go. It was a place where everybody knew everyone, everybody cared about each other, and we all shared the commonality of ethnicity, values, and goals. It was probably the time where I most felt like I belonged and where I was accepted and loved. I miss it. I've never experienced it again. I'm glad I had the opportunity. But because of cultural genocide, that was taken away. All the memories I had of that place is bittersweet, because I'm now looking back on a thing that I've lost. As much as I loved it then, it's gone. And what troubles me most now is what may become of the remaining two icons of J-Town, with the talk of this, I don't know what you want to call it, this sort of, I'm trying to be diplomatic. We're trying to build something to make a rich guy richer on the backs of the people, of all the people who are going to have to pay for it. There's talk now about allowing zoning changes so that they could have buildings of unlimited height. So if you take that Stroud building now, which is three stories high, and you put a 25-story building directly on the property line of Japanese Church of Christ, yeah, the church will still be there, but it'll become irrelevant and unenjoyable for the people who want to use that. And the same goes for the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple. What will happen if they're allowed to remain, but their use of their property and the use of that area there is so diminished? So there's a lot of apprehension about what may come down the pike here. But if you're talking about replacing the atmosphere and the feelings that that place generates, at least for me, probably not. If you do allow new Japanese businesses and restaurants and shops and things like that along that street, maybe not for me, that won't be the same, but maybe for my kids, my grandkids, or those who are coming down the line, maybe they will have the opportunity to have that same kind of feeling that I was able to have a place where they could go celebrate their culture, celebrate their heritage, and enjoy all of that. So I think it's worth a try.
Paul Iwasaki, he's a former juvenile court senior judge. He grew up in Japantown. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you with comments or suggestions. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.